Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.
My name's Paul Bestall, and you're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. The world is a possibility, if you'll only try. My guest today is author, musician, narrator, writer, and all-round cryptozoological expert, in my opinion, Lyle Blackburn, who joins me today from Texas. Good morning. Welcome to the show, Lyle.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Hey, my pleasure. So, bit of a busy period for you at the moment. A lot going on.
Yeah. Seems to be always a busy period, and increasingly so. So, but you know, that's a good thing.
Absolutely, yes. Well, I've noticed there's a lot going on, as in regards to Boggy Creek. Obviously, I've seen that you've been doing some film work for the Blu-ray re-release. Is that right?
Right. Yeah, I'm kind of come to be involved in just about anything that happens in relation to the Boggy Creek monster case, and we are involved in a restoration process of the original Legend of Boggy Creek movie from the 70s, and we're going to include some bonus features on the Blu-ray, which is interviews with some of the original actors. So I already knew several of the actors, and working with the original director Charles Pierce's daughter, Pamela Pierce, and so I was kind of heading up the interviews and so forth with the actors.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, because for me, you've become synonymous with the Boggy Creek case for better or worse. I think, you know, obviously with your book, you know, the first book that you did in regards to the Boggy Creek case, and then obviously returning to that. Have you found, you know, alongside the film for Small Town Monsters, have you found that obviously the way you approach the book and how respectful you were has allowed you to be, are people more candid with you because they've seen you've treated the subject with respect?
Absolutely. I think it's something that my reputation and the way I've gone about, you know, doing the writing and whatever work we've done in film has allowed people to be comfortable with me and to know that their stories are handled with respect. You know, whereas early on when nobody knew who I was, or especially when I just showed up in the town of Falk, you know, a decade ago, you know, claiming I was going to write a book and this and that, you know, they don't know me from anyone. So, you know, naturally people are reluctant to speak with me. But, you know, fast forward now, people are happy to share the experiences, and they want to, because they want to tell somebody, but they want to tell somebody who's going to take them seriously. And so that has obviously helped me a great deal to, learn about other sightings that occurred in the past, or if there's a sighting that's recent, people are happy to tell me about it. So that's a great thing.
Mm. So obviously, for those who are unaware of the Boggy Creek case, which I find quite hard to believe if you're interested in anything of this nature, what was the catalyst to get you involved in it and want to, write a book and take it from there?
Well, essentially the story became public in 1971 when there were sightings of a Bigfoot-like creature in southern Arkansas in the area of Falk, which is a small town just across the border from Texas where I live. Yeah. And these sightings were talked about in the newspaper. There was kind of a sensational sighting at the beginning where someone was attacked by this alleged creature and ended up in the hospital. And then following that, there were several other incidents where people saw an ape-like creature crossing the road and so forth. And that attracted the attention of a would-be film director from Texarkana, which is the closest big city to Falk, by the name of Charles B. Pierce, who ended up making a movie called The Legend of Boggy Creek, which came out in 1972. And that kind of made the case obviously much more famous and well-known, and people of a certain age all saw that movie. I mean, hundreds of people literally come up and say, oh man, that movie scared me to death as a kid, and all that. So I was fortunate to have seen the movie in the early 1970s myself in a drive-in theater, and having an interest in Bigfoot and Loch Ness Monster and things like that, it obviously attracted my attention. It was kind of done in the style of a docudrama horror film, and I was a big horror film buff, even at an early age. So that right there just kind of cemented my fascination with the case. It was something that was about 3 hours from my house in Texas, so it was a kind of a local phenomenon, and ever since then I was fascinated. So when it came to the point of being an adult and having been a musician and also a writer for all these years, I wanted to write a book. And I thought, what is my favorite subject? What would I even want to write a book on? I thought, wow, The Legend of Boggy Creek. What was true about that? What's true in the movie? How was the movie made? Why was the movie made? And that ended up becoming my first book, The Beast of Boggy Creek, which kind of put me on the map. And here we are now.
Absolutely. I mean, it is a really interesting case because, I mean, I was 7 or 8.
Eight.
And it was shown on the UK TV. So it had obviously, it had crossed to the UK, which I always found extremely surprising. That, probably at the same time it was picking up the cult following, in America, it garnered a little bit of a cult following in the UK because it was shown on primetime TV at 6 o'clock on a Friday evening, which looking back was probably not the best time to show a film of that nature because they showed it uncut as well. So as an 8-year-old, I was absolutely terrified when I saw that film, especially the way it comes across, like you say, as a docudrama horror film.
Absolutely. And then that kind of reaction was universal to anybody who saw it at that time, especially kids. The funny thing is, it's a rated G movie, but there's no blood or violence or anything. It was just shot in such a spooky way. And it was based on real sightings. And many of the actors in the film were actually the people who had seen the creature, sort of reenacting their sighting, or it was locals that kind of stood in for others. So it had that very real feel that captured people's imaginations and came across, it's the best format to tell this story. So, and the fact that you saw it in the UK just is a testament of how widely that film was distributed and how many people saw it. So it just made it so super famous. And actually, I couldn't, you know, when I started looking into writing a book, I couldn't believe no one had written a book on it.
Yeah.
I mean, it had been covered in some other, you know, mentioned in other books. Lauren Coleman, for example, you know, would have a section in his Bigfoot books on it, but nobody had dedicated a whole book. And I was thinking, wow, this is amazing. I just cannot believe, as famous as that film was, nobody had written a book. So it was kind of destiny, and it was something that I felt I could do a good job at. And that's kind of how it happened.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things that for me as well, because I know the story and I've seen the film and obviously was fully aware of it. When I found out that obviously your book had come out and read it, I was, you know, as you say, I was stunned to discover that nobody else had really gone after it. And I can't really understand it now, unless people who saw the film just thought, well, it's just a film and that's it, and didn't really look past the entertainment aspect of it and just thought, well, here we are, we've got a monster movie set in the southern states of the US. And left it at that. But like you say, obviously the film featured a lot of people who recreating their own sightings and their own experiences, and then it was all shot on in the area and in the actual locations where some of these sightings had occurred. So it was almost like you say, it was probably destiny. You know, it was your favourite story, you loved it, and the opportunity arose, and then there you were. I've just found that really surprising, like you say, that nobody else had decided to tackle it.
Yeah, I think it was lucky, and I, without being biased, I felt I could tell the story the best because I'd been there and seen it as a kid. I had the interest in it. I lived in the close proximity, and I was somewhat obsessed with it. I remember being I was on tour with my band at some point, and this was I don't even know what year, but I was in a truck stop and I saw it on DVD, and I was like, oh my gosh, I hadn't seen this so many years. And I think I had a VHS of it or something, but I didn't have a digital copy, and I bought it, and I had a laptop that would play DVDs, and I would sit in the van and watch that thing every night before we had to get on stage. You know, the rest of the guys were in there, you know, whatever, hanging out at the bar, whatever. I'm in the van by myself watching this film over and over. They thought I was nuts, and I was like, I'm just obsessed with this. So I'm glad that nobody wrote a book, because that just gave me the opportunity to be the one to do it.
I think one of the strengths of the book is, you know, as you referred to earlier, is that, you know, you've come into that town as a stranger, really, and obviously we can now look back and see what happened, you know, after the original release of the film, where a lot of people were not necessarily humiliated, but as is often the case in situations like this, there was a lot of negative response to the people. So when you got into folk, how did you go around, you know, building that reputation of, you know, and getting people's trust to come forward and talk to you honestly?
Well, you know, at first, I just kind of asked around, trying to find people that, you know, knew something about it or had sightings and things like that. And fortune was with me, because immediately I was introduced to a guy who had been there during all this. He was a teenager in the early 70s, and his mother had been the one that cast some of the original footprints. And he had a great interest in this. He owned a place called the Monster Mart, which is a convenience store there in Falk that is the only place where you can see, you know, have things to see. It's a lot different now than it was when I first went in there a while back. You know, I was quickly introduced to him, and he kind of, you know, drove me around, showed me sites. And then I was introduced to a guy who runs a local museum there that's a historian on the area. And by return, you know, they probably thought I would never come back, but by returning a couple of times and, you know, talking to, you know, the guy at the museum and things like that, he you know, he knew I was serious, and he then could kind of arrange people to come do an interview, because he would call them and say, look, this guy's, you know, I think he's doing a great thing here, and, you know, I think you should come down and talk to him. So once I had a few key people in town, especially a historian who was kind of on my side, then that kind of opened the doors to for people to talk to me. So, you know, and then obviously once the book came out and everybody read it, and I included a lot of historical aspect about the town of Falk, and I just tell the story. I don't try to convince people one way or another. I just say, hey, this is what people claim to have seen, and let me tell you, these people are credible. Here's how it all went down. Once they read the book, they thought, okay, this is great. I mean, you know, nobody's laughing at us. There's no snickers. It reflects what we feel about it. We can't prove it or explain it, but this is the facts about the case. And that obviously now makes it, I can show up in the town and, you know, there's, I know probably more people there now than I do in my own neighborhood.
Well, I suppose that's a good thing, Lyle, and I think it speaks volumes to the way that you treated the subject as well, because, you know, one of the things I took from reading the book was how respectfully you treated the whole story and the people, because, you know, once you dig into it, it is, you know, it is on the record that, you know, the amount of belittlement that went on to some of the people, and, you know, and the allegations that were made against people like Smokey Crabtree and things like that, that, you know, obviously would set people up for being really wary, especially when it had been put to bed for quite a while as well, for you to then turn up. But like you say, because of the way you were with people, it probably did you find that more people were coming forward because of the way you'd treated some of the original witnesses?
Yeah, I think so. Especially once the book had been out, you know, and then it was, you know, people, I was more known, and then I was on several television shows as the, you know, so-called expert, a historian on the case or whatever, you know, which, you know, cast me in a bigger light. And then, yeah, just people would then, you know, share their stories. Or if now, of course, if there's any sort of sighting in Falk, you know, if it's all routed towards me, I should have a Foggy Creek hotline or something.
Yeah, very much so.
So yeah, it's easier to get reports now, and people trust me, you know.
I think it's one of those people that, you know, and it's testament to the quality of the book and the work that you put into it, that you've basically become, you know, without wishing to label you, Lyle, as the go-to man when it comes to Boggy Creek and the Falk Monster and the stories around it. And like I say, I think that's just real credit to the support that you've shown the town. And obviously, if anything, it's probably helped them embrace that period of their town's history.
Oh, it certainly has. I mean, and the difference between when I first walked into the Monster Mart a decade ago, you know, there was something to see, but not much. There's a mural on the outside of the store. Inside, there was a few newspaper clippings sort of pinned on a corkboard. There was a few books, like Smokey Crabtree's books, were being sold. I'm like, wow, I can't believe this is all there is to see. You know, this is a huge legend. You know, people come from all over to Falk just to see it. And now, you know, as a result of not only the book, but shortly thereafter, you know, we did episodes on Finding Bigfoot and Monsters and Mysteries in America and other things. It kind of gave a resurgence and a new appreciation for what is one of the most famous Bigfoot cases out there. And so now, you know, you go to the Monster Mart, it is the outside is a complete new facade with this giant Bigfoot coming over the roof, and that looks like a swamp scape with cypress trees. And you go inside, there's like a small museum that I've helped to set up. You can see historical items. There's a, you know, a gift shop, and, you know, a display with all my books. And I mean, it's completely different. And, you know, that's due in part to, you know, just kind of the book sparking some, you know, something that has translated into, hey, this is a great part of history, a great part of the legend. And if you live in Falk, you know, people were saying, hey, you know, this is what it is. You know, some people are proud of it. Some people think it's silly, but on the whole, the mayor and everybody else appreciates it and embraces it at this point.
Yeah. So they've learned to love it, really.
Yeah, I mean, very much so. And, you know, we've done a Falk Monster Festival down there for several years, and I've done guided bus tours and things like that. And it sounds like it's being commercialized, but that's really not the case. It's not like, you know, this, we're not building amusement parks and there's not millions of people coming down there. It's just simply people are interested and they want to see these places and they want to come to Falk and, you know, they want to go to Boggy Creek just because it's something that, you know, is imprinted in their own mind. You know, they saw the movie as a kid, or, you know, they want to bring their kids there, or they love Bigfoot and they want to go to famous Bigfoot sites. So, you know, you have all these people coming and it's nice to be able to have something there from, you know, a small museum to a festival to where it makes their trip more worthwhile to come down there.
Absolutely. And I think it's also gives the town a the potential to showcase it. We're not just about Boggy Creek. There is, you know, there is more to us than just this story here. And there's a very, it's reminded me the way that, you know, obviously since your book and the Small Town Monsters documentary, that it's a very similar way to how Point Pleasance has learnt to sort of come to terms with the Mothman and why people come there because of that. For me, I think it's quite a similar situation, that obviously, you know, there is a bit more to Mothman because of obviously what happened with the Silver Bridge collapse. But I think sometimes some of these places seem to think, oh, well, you know, let's just keep it there and not remember it and hope nobody comes. But I think now it's very similar to you know, the way, for example, say somewhere like Loch Ness has fully embraced the culture of having a local legend and a monster in their vicinity.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that reflects modern times where, you know, it's they're not as embarrassed about it, or people don't, I guess more like people don't think you're crazy because you say you've seen things like this. We've seen plenty of television shows where, you know, average people, you know, could be your neighbor. I've seen something strange. So it's not as doesn't seem as, you know, culturally a stigma if you claim to see something like this. So I think as a result, the towns are like, hey, this is, you know, and now it's become part of their history and it just is what it is. And like, you know, Point Pleasant can embrace the Mothman and Falk can embrace the Boggy Creek Monster. Bishopville can embrace the Lizard Man or whatever. And it doesn't mean they necessarily believe or don't believe. It's just that they recognize it's a part of their town history. And hey, let's have fun with it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So since you've done both books, have you found that there have been some, you know, fairly recent sightings or anybody's had a recent experience that they've basically said, you'll never believe I've had an experience as well?
Yeah, there's been, you know, quite a few recent sightings. I see that question all the time posted on Facebook, you know, even people that follow my page and follow the Falk Monster page, which I'm puzzled at because I'm constantly posting, of course, in my books. I did a follow-up to The Beast of Boggy Creek called Beyond Boggy Creek, in which I then examine similar cases all throughout the deep south of the United States, which is roughly about 10 of our states. And in that, I kind of offer some updated encounters from the Falk area that, you know, that I didn't have when I, you know, finished The Beast of Boggy Creek. And in the years, you know, there's been, you know, at least a handful each year of what I consider some credible sightings in the same areas. And this Falk is an area where there's this, there's a Sulphur River in the Sulphur River bottoms. There's a bayou down in there. It's a very rugged and remote kind of place. It's undeveloped, and it's still as undeveloped mostly undeveloped as it was back in the 70s, because a lot of that, it's just, you know, sanctioned off as wildlife management areas or duck habitat. And it's great that they've kind of kept it that way. So I think that it's plausible that if a creature or creatures, a population of these things existed down there at one time, they could very well exist down there now. Hmm. And, you know, these sightings that I get reports of now are great because I can literally interview the person personally shortly after the incident. I can go up there and interview the person in person, and I can go to the place where it was seen. So that's kind of an advantage about examining these modern sightings as opposed to me writing about historical sightings. So yeah, there's been some really good ones, and the most recent one would have been that I got was from October of last year, in which two women were driving a little bit south of Falk, nearby, not too far from where Boggy Creek crosses this old highway, and they saw something run across the road on two legs. It had a long stride. It was agile enough to where they believed it wasn't, you know, a person in a costume or anything silly like that. And this thing was moving at a pretty good rate and ran off, you know, eventually into the trees and out of sight. But they were fairly confident that what they saw was something unusual. And I was able to get that report, and I was able to go right there. I know the exact area where it was seen. So it is an area where I've had other sightings reported over the years.
Fantastic. I mean, that is the benefit, because obviously, you know, as you say, for you, it's just down the road, really. So, you know, you are quite fortunate that you've fallen in love with a monster that's pretty local. But there was something that was mentioned, because I've been watching the new Small Town Monster series in the Trail of Bigfoot. And there was something that was mentioned in that I've never really thought of before. And it was all about the kind of difference between your kind of West Coast and then your kind of East Coast cryptids, in regards to the ones on the East tend to be a bit more aggressive and angry in comparison to your traditional Bigfoot hotspots of, you know, Oregon, Washington State and Northern California. Is that something that you've considered in regards to Boggy Creek, or do you think it's somewhere in between? Because it's a bit more, when you look at some of the historical reports anyway, that certainly seems to be a bit more of not necessarily aggressive, but it certainly seemed a bit more forthcoming in making its presence known, shall we say.
Yeah, I think, you know, more often than not, you do have more aggressive behavior exhibited in the southern cases or the eastern cases in the U.S. Certainly so. I mean, there's a little bit of distortion, especially in the Legend of Boggy Creek, because the movie itself and some of the, you know, most famous sightings really were played up the aggressive part of it, you know, whereas, you know, there's plenty of other sightings that have happened where it was simply crossing the road or it didn't come running at people or something like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you look back historically at, you know, Sasquatch sightings in the Pacific Northwest or on the West Coast, you have a lot of tales, Native American tales, where these creatures were thought to be devious or even evil. They kidnapped children and things like that. So it's not as clear cut as you may think, where, you know, the Bigfoot of Pacific Northwest is simply a friendly giant and the ones down here are just out of control maniacs. It's a little bit dispersed, but you know, that being said, they're in the case of some of these Legend Boggy Creek, some of the skunk ape incidents from Florida. There's cases of Bigfoot aggression in states like Ohio, which would be a north central northeast part of America. There's aggressive incidents and some of them quite frightening to imagine something like that, a 7-foot tall ape-like creature, you know, coming at you. And, you know, I have an affinity, a fondness of those kind of sightings. They're because, you know, they're very much Legend of Boggy Creek. It's frightening and scary. And my gosh, what is it these people are seeing and experiencing? So I'm always partial to those kind of sensational sightings.
Yeah, absolutely. It gives it some kind of different kind of aspect. I think if there's some kind of sort of, you know, obviously the famous clip in the film is obviously where the arms come through the window and everybody starts screaming and you know, you can do that. And obviously, like, you know, as you refer to, there are cases that, you know, you're in the Washington state, obviously in California, you think of Ape Canyon is a prime example, and that's not a very friendly situation at all once you dive into that, which was something I was mentioning to Seth last week when we were talking about the series, about how it gave me a bit more information in regards to that situation, because I just thought it was one particular incident, and then obviously thanks to the show, I've discovered a lot more about that particular case. So yeah, maybe it's just, you know, that East Coast West Coast rivalry, and it's crossed over from the rap world into you know, trying to get your cryptids against each other. I don't know, to be honest, Lyle. So obviously you referred to Pamela Charles Pierce's daughter earlier, who's she's now taken ownership of the film again, because it was out in the public domain for quite a while, wasn't it?
Well, it's never been in the public domain, yeah. Although it was thought to have been. Mm. That's the thing. It's it was kind of a murky waters as to where the ownership had gone, or if it had been transferred or anything like that. But it has always been owned by the Leadwell, the Leadwells, who were the original investors in the movie, allowed Charles Pierce to make it in the first place. They've always owned it. It's just that they're not in the movie business or anything like that. So it just sort of fell into this sort of wild west of bootlegs and uploads on YouTube and all this other nonsense. And finally, you know, Pam has, you know, she understands the importance of her father's works and things like that, and is at a point in her life where she had the opportunity to, you know, really do something about it and get a hold of this and to perpetuate a restoration of the film, which is long overdue. You know, we have all this modern digital technology, and to be able to transfer from an original print at a 4K resolution to result in what, you know, is not only restored to the way it looked originally, but perhaps even better than it's ever looked. I mean, you see details in the film, in the restored version, that you can't see in all these dubbed over second generation versions that are out there currently on DVD or what have you, that are very dark. And I mean, this film was beautifully shot, and the direction on it, especially for a first time director, is so impressive that finally people will be able to see this. And certainly collectors have been waiting and waiting for so long to get this movie on Blu-ray. So most of it's just a matter of Pam cleaning up the legal issues and getting ownership. She now has ownership of the film herself. I mean, she is the sole owner. And I've been working with her for quite a few years once she recognized I'd written the book. And I had actually found the original oil painting of the movie poster and owned that, which kind of had left the hands of the family under less than desirable conditions. And I transferred ownership back to the family where it really should belong, and to her. And, you know, we're working on displaying the painting in a museum in Arkansas, perhaps. And we're also, you know, collaborating, obviously, on the restoration of the film, because, you know, before Pam kind of got involved, you know, I was kind of the only champion of the movie, I guess, being recognized. And then, but I didn't have the power, obviously, that somebody who is, you know, the daughter of the director has. So once we teamed up, and man, she's really just done some great things, then finally I think that, you know, here comes another resurgence in the film, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. Because obviously I know, you know, I've got to know Pam, obviously certainly not on the level you have, because of, you know, your excellent work and expertise in the situation, Lyle. But it's been really pleasing to see how she's basically just grabbed this grasp the nettle of this whole situation, like you say, with the legality of it, because, you know, I'd completely, it had, you know, dropped out. And it was one of those films that I'd looked for years to see if it had popped up on Amazon or something like that, and it never appeared. And I was just thinking,
hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Surely I can't be the only person that has these thoughts about how this film affected me as a child, you know, when I was younger. So to see what's happened over the last sort of 12 to 6 months and the momentum that Pamela's had behind her in regards to getting, you know, taking the ownership, pulling it back in and treating the film with the respect it deserves, I think, you know, like I say, you know, having it redone and cleaned up and tidied up and repackaged ready, because I think Pamela's on about doing a big launch later on in the summer, isn't she?
Right. Yeah, we're going to, you know, the film is, it's not quite done with the restoration. It's still working on the audio, but the film itself will be ready to preview and show in the summer. So she's booking some showings at select theaters, mostly around here in the South. And that's going to help generate some of the funds necessary to, you know, go forward with either the Blu-ray or paying for the bonus materials, because at this point we're basically self-financing this stuff, kind of keeping it, you know, without selling over rights or doing anything, we're keeping it, you know, close to the vest for now. And so obviously things like this are expensive with restorations and shooting, you know, behind the scenes documentaries and what have you. So by showing these films, it allow people to re-experience them in the theater and allow to bring in a little bit of income, and then that can help, you know, facilitate the rest of the process to get it restored and to be released on Blu-ray.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, by all, it sounds to me as though, like you say, I think it's about when it comes back. I think for a lot of people, that there's a lot of anticipation about this film. I mean, I can't wait to see it cleaned up, because obviously, first time I saw it was on TV, so it was probably one of the first prints that was used back in those days. But since then, you know, like I say, until sort of 6-7 months ago, you would just find really bad, grainy copies floating about on YouTube that do nothing to benefit the film, really.
Right. Yeah, I've always, it's just annoyed me at the quality and the people up finding the need to upload crummy versions, and just all that just drives me crazy. I mean, it's better than nothing. You people can see it, but this whole state of just how it's been, you know, there's a so-called widescreen version that somebody released that's, while it is the widescreen, it's the most horrible quality of them all. And it's like, like you say, it's not helping anything. This just makes the film look, you know, extremely low budget and crappy, when in fact, I mean, it was produced in Technicolor and the thing looks absolutely amazing and kind of what I remember seeing in the drive-in theater way back. You know, these versions I see now are, they're just so much dark and they just don't look like they should. So I think finally people will be able to see it. And if you follow like my Falk Monster page on Facebook and things like that, I've been posting some sneak previews of the the restored version, and you can also follow the Legend of Boggy Creek page on Facebook, which is run by Pam herself.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen a couple of bits of it, and it looks like a different film, to be honest.
Yeah, totally.
Brilliant. No, well, I can't can't wish Pam and the family more success than that, because I think it's a cracking film, and I think it's one of those films, I think it's probably deserved this treatment for quite a long time. And I think with your book and obviously the return, you know, the Beyond Boggy Creek book as well, and this, it just seems like everything's aligning to pull it back to where it belongs and give it the respect that it deserves. But the, you know, there's loads of films that can, you know, Boggy Creek's one of those films that I think its influence at the time can't be understated as well, because there are loads of documentaries around that period that came out that clearly have used Boggy Creek as a template to go forward. And they're the same, that they've just basically, they all look like they've been uploaded on VHS. The quality is atrocious. And it's a real shame, because some of these films are brilliant.
Yeah. A lot of those were copied from the VHS to digital. They weren't taken from the prints. You know, the original VHS was taken from a print, and then the subsequent so-called DVD releases are just filmed versions of the second generation versions of the VHS. So, but yeah, like you say, that literally the Legend of Boggy Creek was kind of the template for all these modern shows. You know, they have the witnesses reenacting the case. I mean, it's mind blowing to look at it and to realize what a pioneering achievement this was for 1972, and how it's affected the culture of, you know, Bigfoot and cryptids ever since, because everything is sort of reflective of what Charles Pierce and his style and the way he delivered the story back then. It's just.
Welcome to Kraken Mare, the biggest liquid hydrocarbon ocean on Saturn's moon Titan.
And this is just one of the places you get to visit and learn about when you listen to the Hostile Worlds podcast.
The Hostile Worlds podcast, which is, of course, a science-based audio drama documentary series that teaches you all about our universe in a fun and entertaining way.
Head on over to hostileworlds.net to subscribe on your podcast app of choice.
From the television series that are on now, like Finding Bigfoot and things like that, to the movies that are being made. There's a lot of Bigfoot horror films that come out, and they all want to be the Legend of Boggy Creek. You can
absolutely
tell.
Yeah, absolutely.
They get nowhere near, nowhere near. And even using technology today and probably in much better costume quality and stuff, they just can't touch it, because there was something magical about that film. That was just perfect for the subject matter and perfect for the time period in which it debuted.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've seen too many bad films ripping off Boggy Creek over the years, I have to be honest. You know, whenever I see a hairy arm come through a window, I think, I know exactly where you've got that from. You know? So it's just one of those things. So I hope it's a massive success for the family and yourself getting involved with that. I think that's really nice. And I think that's such a sweet gesture when you've given them the painting. I think that's really, really, really humbling, that, Lyle. That's lovely to hear. So, obviously, following that, you've also ended up doing quite a lot of work with Seth Breedlove and the Small Town Monsters. So, how did that come about? Because obviously, I think was the first one you did with them was the Mothman.
Well, actually, the first one was Boggy Creek Monster.
Sorry, my apologies.
Which made obvious sense, I mean, and perhaps there's no other more famous small town monster than, you know, Mothman and the Fout Monster, Boggy Creek. So, you know, Seth wanted to do that. And obviously, if you're going to do a Boggy Creek film, you know, it's best to collaborate with me. I had the witnesses. I had the story. I had the voice for it. And, you know, we enjoyed our collaboration on that. We were happy with the way it came out, especially given what, you know, the budgets that he had and things. And then so it was so successful that the next film, which was The Mothman of Point Pleasant, we thought, well, hey, let's keep this up. So I came on as a co-producer, and I helped with the script and narrated it just as I had done with Boggy Creek Monster. And, you know, again, we got great feedback from everybody that about those films. So we've continued that. I just recently narrated Bray Road Beast, which is about the dog man werewolf kind of case from Wisconsin. Yeah. And I'll be narrating and involved in the next two coming productions this year, which is Terror in the Skies and Momo.
Yeah, I was saying to Seth, I really like the work that the Small Town Monsters guys are doing in general, because, you know, as we were saying about your book, you know, The Beast of Boggy Creek, I think the way Seth treats the witnesses and the stories and the way everybody who's involved in it, you know, because I've seen them all now. So I just find them really well made and extremely respectful to everybody's involvement, because you're giving people another opportunity to come forward and open up. But I find it really refreshing that you're just saying, right, here's the story, here's what people have said, make up your mind.
Right, and that's one reason Seth and I work well together, because we're kind of on the same vibe as to how we approach these subjects. And, you know, if I was to make films, they would just look like what Seth is doing. So, you know, it's great because, you know, I do books and cover some TV shows and so forth, and he does the film. So we're kind of covering all grounds with that and collaborating together. So we just work, you know, and everything he thinks of as sort of the approach or how we're doing things, I always completely agree with. So it's an easy collaboration to work together. And I'm glad to be a part of the Small Town Monsters team, and especially because it's a small group of guys, and, you know, we're not answering to other people or with big budgets and this and that. We can do it the way we want. And that makes it more satisfying. And the response to the films obviously is just overwhelmingly positive. So that's, you know, I'm always happy to do anything that Seth feels is the next step, because so far it's all been great.
Yeah. I think, you know, going back to what you said about the way you two work together and if you were doing that, it's the way you'd make the film. I think that's what I really like, because we're dealing with niche subjects here. You know, these are, you know, cryptozoology and such like is, you know, it is a fringe subject regardless of which one we talk about. But I think Seth works on the same principle as I do. So, you know, as you refer to, if I want to talk about Boggy Creek, then the first person that comes into my mind is yourself. You know, as you mentioned, the Beast of Bray Road there, the thing about that, as soon as I saw that film was coming out, I thought, well, there's only one person that they can possibly speak to here about that case, and that's Linda Godfrey. Because, you know, very similar to yourself in regards to the Falk Monster, you know, Linda Godfrey is the Beast of Bray Road, essentially, because she's the lady that dealt with it. She's brought it into the public domain, and she's continued to keep, keep that story and these incidents alive.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's all worked out.
Mm. I mean, Linda's a fantastic journalist. I've got quite a few of her books, and it was just really... It's probably the Small Town Monsters film that makes me just scratch my head the most, thinking, just what on earth is going on here?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you know, I have a lot of respect for Linda. She was doing this sort of thing, you know, before Seth and I, and her approach to it is very much the same as mine, especially in a journalistic sense. And so she's kind of pioneered a little bit of this. And especially when you hear Linda talk about it in an intelligent way and how she's approached it sort of journalistic, it does make you scratch your head, because you're like, this stuff isn't made up. This stuff is, I mean, there's something to this. People saw something. Mm-hmm. And that just makes the whole thing even more eerie, because, you know, it doesn't sound like it. I mean, it sounds like almost like a bizarre and crazy subject, but the way it's delivered and we hear the witnesses and hear Linda, you're like, well, this, it may sound crazy, but hey, there is something to this.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you said, I think the grounding, the fact that she was working as a journalist when this story landed in her lap, really, what was it, 91? I mean, it's nearly 30 years ago. And here we are still talking about, you know, the Beast of Bray Road. And I mean, the Dogman phenomenon has just, you know, probably over the last 10 years or so, probably exploded from being a real, you know, minor part of the world of cryptozoology to being quite a major one now.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, it's one of those. I think the popularity of the so-called Dogman phenomenon is increased in the last couple of years, as more of these sightings are publicized, and, you know, as you know, the more people have been tuned into the Beast of Bray Road even. But yeah, it has gone to just one of those hugely famous cases. And I mean, one of the more creepy ones, because you're dealing with something that, you know, sort of dwells in that werewolf kind of realm. And that's even almost, most people say I'd rather see a Bigfoot than a dog man, you know?
I'm there on that one. I think if I had a choice of which monster I was going to see, my money would be I'd rather see the Bigfoot. Thanks. It's not really, I'm not fancying bumping into a dog man anytime soon. So the next thing you're doing with the Small Town Monsters is Terror in the Skies, I believe.
Right. In that case, I'll strictly be the narrator, the voice on that one. You know, I've researched and gotten reports of strange flying creatures, from things that would resemble pterosaurs to things that are in a sort of a Thunderbird nature or Mothman kind of a nature. But yeah, and I think this film's going to be really cool and give us an opportunity to examine some other phenomenon that's, you know, a little bit different than Bigfoot and different than Mothman.
When I was talking to Seth, obviously he's looking at, you know, the work that Lauren's been doing over the, you know, pulling these reports together, and obviously you've got people like Lon Strickler who are pulling in these flying cryptid reports coming from his area as well. It's probably something that it has needed a real look at it, in regards to, you know, I know Ken Gerhardt's done a lot of work in regards to these, hasn't he?
Yeah. Ken's probably one of the, you know, Lauren Coleman, Ken Gerhardt, they've, you know, would be recognized as the guys who have done a lot of research into this and have collected a lot of witness encounters. And, you know, Ken Gerhardt he was interviewed for Terror in the Skies, so it's exciting to have him kind of come on board and be a part of one of these films as well. So, yeah, I think that I'm really excited. The trailer that is going to drop or will have.
Yeah.
The trailer is something that I think people are going to really enjoy, because it just looks really, really good.
I mean, I always get excited when I see keeping up to date, and it's coming and all this. And, you know, it's an exciting big month coming up, because obviously, you know, the Kickstarter started and the trailer is out there. You've got on the trailer Bigfoot coming out as well. So it's a massive year for Small Town Monsters as well, because obviously that nicely leads into both your new book and the final Small Town Monsters film of this year.
Right. Yes, Momo the Missouri Monster.
Absolutely.
So with this, it's kind of been coincidental, really, that I've got a book coming out on the subject, and we've also got a Small Town Monsters film in the same year. But it's something that Seth has been wanting to do for a while, and it's come up as sort of on the list of ones that it's going to be done. And with it just kind of was the right timing, and I'd been working on a Momo book for a while. So I said, hey, you know, I've kind of done the research here. So that'll obviously help. And the timing is just right. So my book will come out, you know, about 6 months before the movie, which in this case, the movie's going to be, it's going to have a little bit different style. Each of the Small Town Monsters movies has kind of a little bit of its own, you know, style and approach, and Momo is going to be one that's going to really be exciting. It's a, you know, so it's not just like a rehash of my book or anything like that. It's going to take it. It's going to complement the book. You know, the book has got all the, you know, the documented history, the rundown of just everything that went on. And then the movie is going to sort of visualize and play up on the famous parts of the case and bring it to life on the screen in a little bit different way than just simply, you know, telling the story from, you know, beginning to end and so forth.
Mm. So, to be fair, it's not a cryptid I was overly familiar with. So, without giving too much away of the book and the film, what is Momo?
Momo is like the Boggy Creek Monster. It's one that came to light in the early 1970s, specifically 1972, and it regarded sightings of a hairy Bigfoot-like creature in the United States state of Missouri, and that's located kind of in the along the Mississippi River, kind of in the central portion of the U.S. And at that time, several witnesses in this small town reported seeing the creature outside their rural homes, particularly in an area called Marzoff Hill, which was this big hill that kind of rose up behind this small riverside town of Louisiana. And the creature was described as being, you know, roughly the size of a man, maybe 6 or 7 feet tall. Stood on two legs, covered in hair. The witnesses said it had a rather large size head with hair that covered its face. And this, these sightings were, made headlines pretty quickly within days of the sightings. And then that kind of perpetuated other people to come forward saying they'd seen stuff. There were subsequent sightings over the next months, from about July 1972 to August 1972. And, I mean, it was one of those stories that was just carried everywhere. It was picked up by the Associated Press and UPI, and it was on all kinds of newspapers. It was covered in newscasts and just a big deal. And kind of, if you were one who followed those kind of subjects in the early 70s and read newspapers, a lot of people were familiar with Momo. And then it was written about in some books in the 70s, covered in Fate magazine and things like that. So it was one that, while it didn't have a famous movie like The Legend of Boggy Creek, it was quite well known to people who followed those subjects at the time. And so Missouri has become, you know, synonymous with its own Bigfoot creature, in which Momo, and to define the name, it's the state abbreviation for Missouri is M.O. And so it would be M.O. for the state and M.O. for short for monster. So Momo was the name that it was given. And that's just become kind of a famous cryptid over here in the U.S. and something that people remember. So it's one that I knew from early on and had read in books, and obviously had become kind of one of my standout and favorite cases.
Yeah. Was it the experience of how well Boggy Creek is, you know, both your books have been received, and they are both excellent. I recommend them highly. I think they're fantastic books. So was it basically you thought, right, well, I'm pretty comfortable in this field now. I'm after my another case that gives you that same kind of passion. And was Momo the next one that you wanted to really tackle?
Yeah. I mean, it's one that's on my list of ones that I wanted to do myself, and where I felt that there, you know, while there's, you know, you can search some blog entries and it's mentioned in other books and all that, again, that never encompasses the whole story, and certain doesn't kind of address all the different theories and the possibilities of what it could be. In the case of Momo, there was some other activity that was associated with the sightings, which included strange lights in the sky, what was perceived as flying objects or UFOs. There was disembodied voices heard in the woods, and just all that stuff. And I really love the kind of classic stories, the 1970s stuff, and ones that are associated with the American South. I mean, Missouri is kind of debatable whether it's included in the traditional North or South, but it's got a lot of aspects of Southern to it. And it's a place where I like my other books, I went there personally to the town and looked at the places, went to Marzoff Hill, and the whole deal, which is always incorporated into my books. I don't just simply sit back and Google stuff and write a book. I found all the original newspaper articles. I went to the town. I interviewed people. And this is sort of my journey as to, you know, examine this case as an adult, a case that I loved as a kid, but like, you know, hey, let's look at the facts behind this case and, you know, see what it's all about.
Yeah, I mean, I was saying something similar to Seth about how he's got to the position he is now in regards to when he does something, because of the body of work that he's already done. Well, and Small Town Monsters as well, because it's not just Seth. Have you found that obviously your reputation in regards to, you know, how respectful you've been in regards to Boggy Creek, that when you've come to Momo, that's helped you once again, having people feel comfortable with you and being able to be honest and open?
Yeah, I think so. In certain cases, I mean, some of the, you know, when I went to the town and talked to some of the original witnesses and so forth, they didn't know who I was. And, you know, when I marched into the library there and announced what I planned on doing and who I was, they weren't highly impressed. You know?
Yeah.
So it's a little bit like starting over. And, you know, but yeah, my confidence in it is high because I know I'm going to deliver a great book, and one that I think the town itself can appreciate. It's documenting the facts behind the case. And, you know, as far as my readership and the people who follow me, I mean, I think they're excited about it simply because they know that my books go above and beyond just some simple summary of the case. This is going to have a lot of cool information. It's going to be told in an entertaining way, engaging narrative throughout the story. And, you know, while sometimes I think, well, you know, people know about this case, why would I need to write more? I realize that my style and my delivery and my thoroughness of these cases, people are really, they want me to do them all. I mean, I get requests to do all, you know, hey, when are you going to cover this or when are you going to cover that? I mean, it's a list I can't even get to, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
or couldn't economically make feasible. But that kind of inspires me to go back and cover some of these ones, that even famous ones like this that have been written about in the past, and do them in my way, because I think I can bring something new to the table, and I know that my readership will enjoy it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm thoroughly looking forward to it, you know, because I've read everything you've done, and I've always found them both extremely fascinating. But there's a clear passion for these subjects in your writing, and I think it shows through. So what, when is it really? Because it's out. Was it forward towards the end of March?
Yeah, March 5th will be the official release date, and I'm not sure whether it'll be available for pre-order prior to that or just be available that day, but it March 5th is the day.
Yeah, and I would imagine that'll be on Amazon and other notable sites?
Yeah, and the usual places, you know, which is primarily Amazon, and I sell, from my own web store, I sell autographed copies, and then it'll also be in ebook format, you know, on Kindle and places like that.
Wow, fantastic. So, I mean, it sounds like you've got a chock-a-block year already lined up, and we're only in sort of February, March time. So, what's next for you? Is it back with the band, or have you got other projects lined up for 2020? Because I know when I was talking to Seth, he's already got, he basically said, well, these are the two films we're doing in 2020. So do you know kind of long-term where you're going to be, or is it just a case of, right, well, I've got Momo first, then you've got the films, and then you've got, obviously, the Boggy Creek re-release in the summer?
Yeah, my life is pretty much planned out for quite some time as well. I mean, because in addition to, you know, the books coming out, you know, I've got to narrate and work on the films. I got to go up to Missouri to shoot Momo in the spring, and I'm booked at events literally starting in late February. I'm booked almost every single weekend through July at some different event in other states and what have you. So I do all that, some band tour dates. We're beginning work on a new album, and I'm about halfway through with another book, and yeah, the Legend of Boggy Creek stuff. There's so much stuff that I don't know how I'm going to do it. I just kind of get literally week at a time.
Oh, Well, all power to you, Lyle. So without wishing to do that, is the other book that you're working on cryptid based?
It is, but okay. Also encompasses a wider net, if you will, into other phenomenon. The book isn't based on one single creature. It's actually based on a certain type of location, which, without giving it away, it's kind of location based, and then whatever has occurred within that area. So areas where there is multiple types of paranormal activity, if you will. So people will see why I covered this when I do announce it. But it's something I've been working on literally for years, because I mean, I'm always interviewing people and always kind of working on things, juggling a little bit at a time as I collect the right information and so forth. So I don't have any idea when I can get another book out, but yeah, I'm working on it.
Good. I mean, and I suppose as well now that you probably find it easier to get information because people probably come to you rather than the other way around these days.
Yeah, in some cases, certainly. And I also, you know, my colleagues, you know, are great, have been a great help. You know, I know who to go to for a particular area. If I say, hey, man, you know, I'm working on something in this area, do you happen to know any witnesses or have sightings? So, you know, without my friends and colleagues, I couldn't do this, you know, to the level I'm doing it, because I need their expertise. The same as somebody comes to me and say, hey, I'm doing a write-up, including Boggy Creek Monsters, in my, you know, top 10 greatest cryptids. What's the latest sighting? So I'm always happy to kind of pass on, hey, well, here's been the latest one. Here's some of the details. So, you know, hats off to my colleagues and the friends I've made over the years that I can go to get some, you know, boots on the ground information as I'm researching the books.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that I think the only way we're ever going to push the boundaries of knowledge and you know, investigation in regards to, you know, some of these creatures is by probably a lot more collaborative work. You know, obviously, you know, with the work that you've done with the Small Town Monsters, but the thing that impressed me about On the Trail of Bigfoot that's going to be the next one that comes out is the vast majority of people involved in that. I think there's 21, you know, Bigfoot cryptid researchers, fans involved in it, and it's just, you know, people from all over the US who have all just come forward to say, yeah, here we are, and we're more than happy to kind of discuss our aspects and our points to this particular phenomenon.
Yeah, it's you know, I may be busy, but Seth boggles my mind. Is that how he pulls off some of this stuff too? I mean, his schedule is crazy. He's cranking out so much stuff, and I mean, we're so busy that I was supposed to be in On the Trail of Bigfoot. We were going to shoot some stuff in Falk, but we couldn't even line up our schedules to do it. So there's no doubt he has plenty of other stuff, and we've kind of covered that anyway in Boggy Creek Monster. So. Yeah, it's going to be I'm excited to see this thing.
Yeah, I can't wait for other people. It's absolutely brilliant. I loved it. And for me, I think 3 hours, the six episodes, and it wasn't long enough for me, but that's just me. But there. Yeah. So, Lyle, thank you. I think you've got, obviously, with an itinerary like that, I think I deserve to let you go. So where can everybody find your websites? When, you know, reconnect when the book's coming out, that type of thing?
You know, the best way to find out more information would be to hit up my website at lyleblackburn.com. And that's got jumps to, you know, where you can get my books, jumps to my online store and even to my band and other related things, such as my Falk Monster website. So just hit up lyleblackburn.com, or you can find me on Facebook at my Lyle Blackburn author page, and you can follow me there, and that'll kind of keep you up to date with all the things I got coming up.
Brilliant. Well, listen, thank you once again. Can't wait for the new book, and all the very best with the Small Town Monster stuff and the re-release of Boggy Creek, and obviously the band as well, Gull Town. So once again, thank you so much for your time today. It's been an absolute pleasure, and good luck with the book.
Thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Take care.
Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.